Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Well, guys, it's the moment I've been waiting for lots of chapters. Like, at least how many chapters have we been doing instructions?
Well, we did, last time we had narrative was chapter 24, so that's...
Okay, and here we are in chapter 32.
In 8 chapters.
And was really excited about this chapter, and studying it made me even, excited and also, mad.
Bummed
and
out.
Disappointed.
The totally bummed out.
But it was just really refreshing to get back into narrative again. And so I'm excited. I think there'll probably be a different energy going back into a narrative section again, especially one as packed as this one.
Mm-hmm.
But as always, before we get into the chapter, we have to start out with Chick-fil-A.
Kids.
Table topic. Roulette.
Yeah.
We didn't do that as well today.
No, we didn't.
Oh, no, we're not on our A game. We can already tell.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to draw. Let's see here. Wait, I've already done this one. Play outside or inside or outside.
Uh-oh, we got them mixed up.
You failed me.
Those darn kids.
Have we done best winter sport? Didn't we?
Do I have to try another one?
Which board games are the most fun? Have we done that?
I don't think we've done that one.
Okay. Which board games are the most fun? Let me think. I don't like Monopoly. I don't really like...
Why don't you like Monopoly? Just too long?
It just takes too long. And, you're going for the same stuff. Boardwalk and Park Place and whatever the green things are.
Whatever the green things are.
Whatever the green ones are. Which board games are the most fun? I guess I don't really like board games all that much. I like card games. We've been playing... we played Unstable Unicorns recently.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Bears versus Babies. I think Unstable Unicorns is probably my favorite.
Yeah, I think
Of those two. But I enjoy playing Munchkin and other card-style games that are like that. I can't really think of a board game that I really, really like.
You mean you don't like playing Chutes and Ladders with Caleb?
I mean, I love my son, and he can play Chutes and Ladders, and he wants me to play Spider-Man Chutes and Ladders with him.
I'm trying to think what other board games we even have.
I don't think we have any.
Yeah.
So,
okay, well, that'll work.
I'm just going to say I like card games, and I like things like Munchkin and silly games like Unstable Unicorns.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm going to go with.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay, let's see how many we have to go through to find the...
Oh, what's something new you'd like to learn this year? This is a hard one, just because I feel like I rarely have time to, learn anything new
mm-hmm.
myself right now with our kids being the ages that they are.
Mm-hmm.
What's something new you'd like to learn this year? I don't know. I'd say probably that's a practical thing. Just cooking better.
Cooking better.
Yeah.
Okay. Cooking more things.
Yeah.
Okay.
And feeling more confident with cooking.
Okay.
Because that's that's what holds me back from cooking is I don't feel confident cooking.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, probably that. Something new you'd like to learn is just how to... And cooking a meal and having multiple things that can come out at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow my mom always does that. And
yeah.
I guess I kind of started this process with when we did Thanksgiving dinner for the first time this year. You know, and we did all the, because of COVID, we did our own Thanksgiving dinner mm-hmm. and everything. And so that was my first.
Oh, and I learned how to do a pumpkin pie.
Yeah.
I did two or three pumpkin pies this year. And so that was cool. I like that because I really do like pies.
Yeah.
strawberry pie, pumpkin pie.
Yeah. So I'd say probably something to do with cooking because I feel like that's something practical that we need in our household too.
Well, I mean, and if you know, like for me, is like I'm constantly thinking of different. Well, I've just like I'm constantly buying new theological books and stuff, mm-hmm. and just trying to like tackle given questions and stuff. Like I don't know, like a lot of times I'm trying to, you know, I might know that a particular person in a group is asking a particular question that I may not feel like I'm really adept on. And so, like, I'll buy something to try to get more in-depth on it and get better understanding of it, you know. But, like, I think, well, one of, well, I've got many books that I've got listed out is, like, what I want that I choose from. I get, Melissa lets me have $40 a month for that. That I can buy.
You should have seen his face when he, you know. I mean, I got the same amount every month.
So. Yeah, but it's money gets allocated differently for Melissa than it does for me.
Hey.
So fun things for you don't like go on your fun budget. They end up like grocery. In a miscellaneous budget. But you know, like there was a book for the priesthood that I was looking into, like better understanding the priesthood and. So I try to do stuff like that, like different. I'll just try to tackle a given topic that I don't feel like I know very well.
Yeah.
And so I do that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's transition into the topic for tonight. So yeah, like Melissa said, we finally have completed the discussion on the tabernacle, and have gotten out of a lot of very detailed instructions how the tabernacle is going to be set up and how the priesthood is going to be set up and inaugurating all of that. And, you know, like you finally get to the end of that and you're like, all right, it's time to do the thing. Mm-hmm. It's time to set all of that stuff up. And so narratively, where you are, the last time we left this off was Exodus chapter 24. They have the feast for Yahweh. And they go and they have fellowship, or they have burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. They ascend the mountain, and a group of 70 elders and Moses and Aaron all eat. Mm-hmm. They have this fellowship with God, and it says that they saw the feet of God, right? That even like seeing the feet of God was just beyond like anything that they could imagine. And that's narrative we left off, and then for it says that Moses ascended the mountain and he went into the cloud and he was there for 40 days and 40 nights. That's the last thing that we remember narratively. And so all this instruction, and you're like, man, I'm ready to get back to the group and see, you know, have the pan back. If you ever watched there's like The Walking Dead, you know, you remember like times where they would have a section. Like one of the episodes would be like about one group, and then like maybe Rick would be in that group and you like love the episodes on that group, and then it like goes to another group and it's like less interesting.
Yeah. You're like,
I just want to get back to like, what happened with Rick? Yeah. What happened with this? Let's get back to that. Let's figure out what happened there. Yeah. And so you're like, you kind of went up the mountain and that's awesome. I don't want to downplay that. Everything about the tabernacle is God setting up and getting ready to dwell in and among his people. That's the purpose of this whole book. That's right. The theme of this whole book. Not only that God is making himself known, but he's also forging a way to dwell in and among his people. He's delivered them from Egypt so that he can be with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tabernacle is an essential part of that. It's his dwelling place with his people. And so it's a really important part of the book. It may be the most important part of the book because it is it's the way that he's developing to dwell in and among his people. So, but you kind of get the feeling of like, all right, well, let's like, what's happening now? And it's like, oh, now we're going to do the thing. Everything that has transpired, we now know about the tabernacle. We know what Aaron's role is going to be. I can't wait to tell Aaron. You know, I can't wait for Aaron to figure out what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we are. And that's kind of I want to build that excitement going into Exodus chapter 32. Many people probably already know what happens, but that's kind of the feeling. You mm-hmm. have the setup of they're going to be the people of God. They've been given the law. They've been given God's wisdom. We just finished it with like he wrote all of his instructions on tablets with his own finger,
right?
So that his people can read and execute his wisdom and live in his way and live, you know, as with him as their king. So that's going to happen, right? That's what's going to happen. And so that's how we feel going into Exodus chapter 32. So let's read this first little section here.
All right. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him." Aaron answered them, "Take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing, and bring them to me." So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord." So the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterward, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, because your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt. They have been quick to turn away from what I commanded them and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and have said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt.' I have seen these people," the Lord said to Moses, "and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation."
So narratively, we've just spent so much time thinking about and reflecting on what the tabernacle is and everything that it represents. And you get to this and you pan back down to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it just is like every step you're like, "No, no, 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 no." You're like, "No, don't do this. This is like, I've just spent so much time thinking about this. And now you, like, the very next time that I see them, they just totally blow it." They yeah. just totally blow it. And so we're going to walk through this. But I mean, this is kind of, you think of like the apex failure moment. I think a lot of times we think of Genesis chapter 3. I think that the children of Israel, when they look back on their scriptures, like this is the moment. This is yeah. like, man, we really messed this up. And yeah. it's been messed up since the beginning. And so I just want, like, this isn't, try to not make this normal to you. Like, just like, "Oh yeah, it's the golden calf." Like, no, like this is, we have spent so much time, God has spent so much time bringing his people out of Egypt to dwell in and among them. We've given them the law. We've gone and given, you know, chapter after chapter of the tabernacle instructions. He's coming down to dwell with them. They're worshiping something else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just narratively, it's really hard to get to this point and see them do this to themselves. So
when I first read this, I was thinking, okay, so basically they're sitting down like, we haven't seen Moses in a while. So, maybe he's, I don't know what was going through their head, if they thought he was dead, if they thought he just left. I'm not really sure where they assumed he went.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like they were like, okay, he's gone. Wherever he is, he's gone. It's been a while. And it made me think of this proverb that says, "Idle hands are the devil's workshop." And it's from Proverbs 16:27. And it's like they're sitting around with nothing to do and they just can't help but try to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And they just chose really poorly, you know, and just kind of in moments where we have nothing to do, we have too much time on our hands, and kind of we usually end up pouring into something that's not the greatest.
Yeah.
Or there's better use of our energy or time or whatever. So I just kind of, that's kind of what I thought of when, mm-hmm. when we were reading that, of just, you know, wow. Yeah. I mean, they just have had too much time waiting, sitting there waiting with nothing really to do.
Yeah.
Cause they don't have these instructions yet.
Well,
and so they're just like
yeah.
twiddling their thumbs like, okay,
they don't what's know, next? They don't know what Moses is coming back down with, but The deal is, I mean, there wasn't any indication that it was going to be 40 days that Moses was going up there.
Right.
And so he kind of, he goes up there. The last time it says he goes into the cloud. We got, you know, what, Holy Fire Mountain God is up there. He walks into the cloud. And there, the people, I mean, there's no indication that it was, like, going to be a long time.
Right.
And I remember us saying, like, at the time, it's like, well, Moses, I hope you packed a lunch, you know, for the 40 days.
Yeah.
And he, so he goes in, and but the people, I think a lot, yeah, we can just think that they were just like, oh, what are we, you know, like, it's been a long time. But I think really what it is they panic. It's been like, this Moses, he's not come back down. He was the guy, like they said, Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt. They attribute what happened in their deliverance actually with Moses and tie it to him. And whenever Moses doesn't come back down, they start to panic thinking that he's died. That seems to be what's happening here. They think he's dead. Like, he's not coming back down. He walked into the fire cloud and we know he's dead. He's dead.
Yeah.
And so in their panic, they make decisions against what they had already agreed to. They agreed to in Exodus chapter 24 of like all of this, what you've said we will do. And they actually kind of, it seems like they go to Aaron and they almost like accost him. They like attack him and say like, hey, come make for us gods who will go before us, because this man Moses, you know, he's dead.
Yeah.
You know, we need something. If we're going to continue, we need a God to go with us if we're going to go to Canaan. And right. I think they panic and they try to seek other means for having the power, you know, like, I guess having that deity power, or I suppose to keep going.
Yeah. And just seeing here how they are attributing Moses as being the one who brought them out of Egypt. It's like, we've talked on probably almost every podcast for Exodus about how this story is about people coming to know who God is, mm-hmm. coming to know God, be in relationship with God. And so it's just like, oh my goodness, they have missed the point. Yeah. Like, they just are not.
And it's been said multiple times, you know, that I'm the Lord. I am Yahweh who brought you out of the land of Egypt.
Yep.
And so, like, that happened in that narrative between Exodus 19 and Exodus 24. I know that was said.
Yeah.
That I am Yahweh who, it's me, Yahweh, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Right. This was the thing that was spoken to them, and they couldn't handle it. They couldn't even handle hearing the voice of God saying that type of thing. And but yeah, now they're attributing it direct, like, to Moses and not to Yahweh.
Yeah. So it's like, verse 1 made me mad, right?
Yeah.
But then verse 2 made me really mad.
Yeah, so why did verse 2 make you really mad?
So it made me really mad because, okay, so now we have Aaron who's like, yep, okay, well, if you want a different God, you're right, Moses has been gone a while, then let's do something about it. Let's get your gold, gather the gold, and, you know, we can make it into an idol. And now knowing, I mean, just like you were saying at the beginning of reflecting on all these instructions that we've been given and Aaron's role as the, like, high priest.
Yeah, we have inside knowledge to what Aaron is supposed to be.
Right.
And now you zoom back down the mountain and you see what Aaron's doing.
Yeah. And he's, I mean, the narrative doesn't give us any indication that he was like, tried to talk them out of it. I mean, I guess that's possible. But it's just like, he just sort of caves under the pressure and doesn't lead in the way that he should have.
Which is that's what Moses has assigned to him whenever he went up. He said, he told Aaron, like, hey, take care of them, like, make sure that they don't do anything stupid.
Handle conflicts.
Yeah, handle the conflicts. Don't make sure they don't do anything stupid. So whenever he's first addressed with this problem, he caves to them. And he tells them to, hey, take off all your gold and you know, from the ears of your wives and your daughters, bring it to me. And all the people took off their rings. So what is it? I mean, this is gold that was probably given to, like, this seems like, narratively, it seems like it was given to them by the Egyptians whenever mm-hmm. they left Egypt. But this is probably gold that you would think is going to be used to do all the tabernacle
all
stuff.
All the poles and...
All the stuff that's required for that. And so it's all the things that were supposed to... They were supposed to take to make the house of Yahweh. They instead use it to make an idol and violate the very first command.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what is... It's like, no, no!
Yeah.
You're just like... I mean, we're thinking, no. Like, how can you do this? Like, this is you're directly violating the first command. Some people will say that's the second command. We talked about that back whenever we did Exodus 20, and how I think that's kind of one in having no other gods before me and not casting idols. All that I think is the very first command. And so, this is violating. Like, if it's not the first command, you're violating the second command.
I mean, it's up there.
Exactly. I mean, like, it's supposed to jar you and be like, man, they can't even, like, for 40 days, they couldn't even do, I mean, the first or the second of the 10 things that seems very straightforward
mm-hmm.
of not yeah. to do. Don't do these things. And they do it. And they break it hardly before it can ever get started.
Yeah, and so then we have what I had a huge question about was then Aaron's like, yeah, I built this calf and everything, but tomorrow there will be a festival to Yahweh.
Yes.
And I was like, but you created a golden calf. What are right. we doing? Like,
yeah.
This seems a bit odd to now... say we're going to have a festival to Yahweh, because there is a difference here in the wording. It's not a festival to these lowercase g gods. It is to Yahweh.
Right.
So
just to be clear, whenever it says these are your gods, it's very ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And they said, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. So they're attributing, to the idol, to this cast image bull, they're attributing it to the things that Yahweh actually did.
Mm-hmm.
These are your gods. That word, it's Elohim, which is ambiguous. Sometimes it's used, actually most of the time it's used for big G God. And sometimes, or other times it's used for the other divine beings, other divine beings that exist, the gods, the Elohim of Egypt, kind of thing. It's ambiguous, and it's intentionally ambiguous here. It's meant to work out, like, do they think that they're worshiping something else? Are they worshiping something else? What's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
They seem to be wanting to worship whatever it is in their mind that brought them out of the land of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
But they're doing exactly that which that being said not to do.
Mm-hmm.
So are they really worshiping that, you know, or are they just worship, you know, again, it's intentionally ambiguous as to what they're worshiping. And then Aaron seeming to try to correct it a little bit, you know, like maybe try to, like, he's saying, okay, I'll do what they're trying to do, but I'm going to dedicate this to Yahweh. He's trying to, like, work it a little bit and, like, mend it somehow, you know, without at the same time, like, ticking them off.
It's like he recognizes that this is not good.
Yeah. Yeah, something about it. But he's attributing, he's saying, you know, a feast for Yahweh tomorrow. And they do exactly what they did in Exodus chapter 24, which is they offer burnt offerings, presented fellowship offerings, and they have a feast.
Yeah, and if you just kind of read that part after the built an altar in front of the calf,
it sounds picked up there. Yeah.
It'd be like, you know, if you just started out with tomorrow, there will be a festival to the Lord. So the next day, the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. It's like,
it sounds exactly great. Like chapter 24. Yeah. It sounds exactly like what they were supposed to do for Yahweh. And so I think the point stands of, like, that man, you know, we can sometimes try to do, quote, the right things or the right actions
mm-hmm.
and stuff, but we can attribute it to, like, whenever we do it for, like, towards and for the wrong reasons, it's not really, we're not really doing God's work, you right. know, like it, because we're, it's hard to explain, I guess, what was kind of in my mind of, like, doing right actions for wrong reasons, but also whenever you're both trying to do good and you're doing evil all at the same time, it's like, that's not good either. You know, like they're, if they attribute it to Yahweh, but they're doing, they're actually violating his first command, it's not really for Yahweh.
Right.
And so I don't know, like, I think there's a lot of things that we should reflect, and we could say, man, you know, like, this seemed like it would be good, but was it really for Yahweh that we did these things? Was it really for God that we did these things? Or were we trying to mix the world in with also with the worship of God? Mm-hmm. And where these two things, like the way that the world behaves when we're behaving the way that their neighbors behave.
Mm-hmm.
By doing this, by casting an image of the bull calf, they're behaving exactly like the Canaanites would behave. And yet they're claiming Yahweh on their lips, right? And so these two things can't be the same. It's just like Jonah, right? Like Jonah, he's on a boat and he's in the middle of a storm and they say, who do you worship? And he says, I worship Yahweh, the maker of the heavens and the earth and the sea,
mm-hmm.
while he's fleeing from God on a boat.
Yeah.
It's like, you clearly don't actually fear him. You don't actually fear Yahweh because your actions are something totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. I guess I just see this. They're attributing to this thing that which Yahweh has done. And that's not right. And they're also, if they are trying to worship Yahweh, they're trying to bring him down to a level that they can control and that they can cast into an image of which is workable for them, you know? And we do that. Like we try to, I mean, that's the old, I mean, the phrase that we've probably heard a lot of, like putting God in a box or trying to make God manageable to the way that we perceive the world.
Yeah.
And so that's what they're doing with Yahweh is they're, I mean, yeah, they're, I don't know. They're trying to fit him into something that they can understand. And it's in direct violation of what his commands were. So there's probably lots of layers to this and lots of things that you could talk about with it. But I just wonder sometimes if, like, you know, do we react to certain things out of fear that maybe something's not going to go the way we want it to, and we say, oh, we'll do this and we'll make this happen. But if it's in direct violation of God's commands, it's not really for God that we're doing it.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, there is an aspect of that it's not just about doing the right rituals, which is the burnt offerings right. and the fellowship offerings. If it's not attributed correctly to God, then none of that matters. And
could really be just, you know, with you saying it like that and doing rituals. I mean, that's kind of like going to the church building on Sunday morning to sit through this process of taking communion and singing, you know, a certain number of songs and everything. But then, you know, we talk about a lot how we create idols in our own
mm-hmm.
world, how yes, it's like, Why would they make a golden calf? Like, that's so ridiculous that you would ever, you know, like, worship a golden calf and then don't realize kind of the golden calves that we create
yeah.
in our own world, the things that we worship or put ahead of God. And it's like, those can be really hard to see. And I mean, unless maybe somebody even points them out for us,
yeah.
I think.
This was totally, just keep in mind, this was totally in line with their culture.
Yeah.
This was totally in line with their culture. And so whatever, yeah, whatever we're supposed to kind of, we could look at this and say, like, what is this kind of to us? I mean, whatever it is, it's going to be in line with our culture.
Yeah.
It's going to, our culture is not going to look at it and be like, that's weird.
Yeah.
That they would that they would, you know, worship that thing or
and honestly,
care about that
honestly,
thing.
I'm for some reason a lot of the things that are coming to my mind are like, well, for one, our country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And then
patriotism can be that way for sure.
I also think of like sports teams.
Yeah.
Which I totally understand because I am a huge, like, I'm a huge Tennessee fan. I listen to like sports podcasts and so like it's not like this like surface level thing for me. So I totally get how it becomes, you know, can become like a something like an idol. Mm-hmm. Trying to think of other things. I mean, it could even be work for people, you know, it's literally anything. And so it's just so interesting to think about, yeah, like doing those things, going through the motion of going to the church building on Sunday mornings, it's meaningless if we're bowing to an idol the rest of the week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in reflecting on the last chapters that we read, which would include Aaron as the representative. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about how as a high priest, he would represent God to the people. What we have is a situation where the one who was supposed to represent God is scared into creating something else that he thinks represents God.
Yeah.
Apart from himself. And so, like, he, you know, this person who is supposed to bear the name of Yahweh. He's already made out to be, you know, I mean, a goon, you know, so that's how the narrative portrays him.
Yeah.
Is that you're supposed to be a leader. You're supposed to be God's representative. That's what you're going to be bestowed with this. And yet, like right out the gate, you're failing. And so that's just how the narrative presents him. And, you know, you just got to take that from the outset. The priesthood does not look good.
Yeah. So then, you know, the Lord now, Yahweh himself, is saying to Moses that his people, as in Moses' people, have become corrupt. So now God is not even identifying as these people as being his own, mm-hmm. because of the choices that they've made. And God is ready to turn away from them. He is ready to just destroy them. And that's kind of interesting because he has always labeled them as his people.
Up to this point, he's talked about them as his people, his firstborn. Israel is his firstborn, his people, the ones whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. And whenever he's speaking with Moses, he knows what's happened down at the bottom of the mountain. It immediately changes to your people whom you brought from the land mm-hmm. of Egypt to Moses. He says it to Moses. He talks about how so quickly they turned away and they went this other direction from the way that I commanded them, and they cast a bull image. And they sacrificed to it and said, these are your gods, Israel. Like he repeats it all. And then he said, and Yahweh said to Moses, I have seen this people, and indeed they are a stiff-necked people. So that stiff-necked people, this is usually used for animals, primarily livestock that you would drive and like send them a direction to go. And so what that means is that they're a people that whenever they're given direction to turn the right way, mm-hmm. they're unwilling to turn, and they're behaving like stubborn livestock, mm-hmm. which happens to be what they're worshiping.
Yeah.
They're worshiping a calf. And so what this kind of is hinting towards, I think, is that they're becoming, they immediately started to become more like the thing that they're worshiping.
Yeah.
That they're becoming like this beast, you know, that like this bull that doesn't want to hear a different way to go. Instead, they're stiff-necked and unwilling. So it's tying the thing that they're worshiping to the way that they're behaving.
Yeah.
That they're actually emulating the thing that they worship.
Yeah.
So he says, and leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them, and let me destroy them, and I will make you into a great nation. And so that little section ends with a Like, I'm going to destroy Israel and I'm going to start over with you, Moses.
And you know, I mean, I think sometimes, I've said this in multiple podcasts, I can get a little triggered when Yahweh says things like this. But in this, like, this one was a little easier for me to read in the sense of just because we've read this all in context, it's like, oh my goodness, he's brought them out of Egypt. He's, you know, like, he's been making all these plans for that. Like, he has been actively working with Moses on the mountain to make sure that he can be in relationship with his people. Mm-hmm. And this is how they are. I mean, I know that they don't know everything yet, but they do know his, they should know some of his character by now.
Right.
To be able to know, like, he's not just going to, like, leave them at this point. And so just to know that behind the scenes you're working on these crazy plans, these elaborate plans to be in the presence of the people, and they are just worshiping a golden calf instead.
What this amounts to, and what the biblical authors later will attribute it to, or liken it to, is that Exodus 24 was the consummation of their marriage. That God comes and he marries Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the last scene that we had with them.
Yeah.
And so what this amounts to is that this is God's wife commits adultery on their very wedding night. On the night that they get married, Israel commits adultery against God.
Yeah.
And so that's what's displayed, the anger that burns. It's like this, like, his wife has already committed adultery against him, and they haven't even really started. They haven't even moved in together yet. Yeah. You know, like,
they haven't built the house.
That's right. Furniture. Yeah. And so, and so that still hasn't happened. And, you know, Hosea will go through that. Hosea is all about that, of how Israel time and time again turns away and commits adultery against their covenant, against their husband, that is Yahweh. And so that's what that amounts to. And so with that, you can understand God, his nose burns, you know, like it flaming nostrils type of thing, burning against Israel. But that's not the last word on the issue. And so Moses is going to have an opportunity here to speak now.
So you can do 11 through 16?
Yeah, so I'm going to do 11 through 16. It says, "And Moses implored Yahweh his God, and he said, 'Why, Yahweh, should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought from the land of Egypt with a great power and with a strong hand? Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent, he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and wipe them from the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger. Relent concerning the disaster for your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, whom you swore by yourself. And you told them, I will multiply your offspring like the stars of the heavens. And all this land that I promised, I will give to your offspring, and they will inherit it forever.' And Yahweh relented concerning the disaster that he had threatened to do to his people. And Moses turned and went down from the mountain, and the two tablets of the testimony were in his hands, tablets written on their two sides, on the front and on the back they were written. And the tablets, they were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets."
Okay, so before we really jump into the nitty-gritty of this section, I just want to talk about Moses in general.
Yeah.
Of just tracking back to the very beginning of Exodus when we, well, not when we met him as a baby in the basket, but but taking it back to how he had always felt like a foreigner because he's born an Israelite, he's raised by Egyptians, he leaves, you know, after he kills the Egyptian master or whatever, and he goes and he marries a Midianite woman. And he is just not really feeling at that point like he belongs anywhere. You know, no one really seems to be his people. there's no one that it seems like he just is really connecting to in term of like a group of people that mm-hmm. he would necessarily be like, that's family. And also as another note of just how he fought with God about, you know, but I can't be the one to speak here.
Yeah, five times he petitioned against that.
Yeah, and so he's going back and forth with God of just like, I don't know that you've picked the right person. I don't speak well. And that's when God's like, oh, I have Aaron for you, which is also kind of ironic now mm-hmm. that we're like seeing.
Which was a concession at the time. Yeah. It was a concession.
Yeah. Yeah. But now seeing also where Aaron is in his story. But just, you know, Moses was not feeling like he could speak, like he could handle this role. I don't know. I just don't know that he was like, yeah, the Israelites are my people at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And so to now, we have this moment where he's making this beautiful, eloquent petition to God to essentially save what he would call, like, I mean, his people. And it's, I mean, he cares enough about the Israelites to want to protect them.
Like, keep in mind here, he is speaking up to God.
Yeah.
And whenever this started, he says, I can't speak to Pharaoh.
Yeah.
And now he's speaking to the creator of the universe, the one that he was in the burning bush that wasn't being consumed, you know?
Yeah.
And so we've come so far for him that he, at once, he was like, I can't go speak to Pharaoh. And now he's standing up and speaking to God and giving his thoughts, you know?
Like, and asking God to remember God's character, like his own character.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get into that. So to be clear, to back up, so, you know, the question is like, okay, is God really going to destroy all of his people? Is he really in for it for that? You don't really get a sense of one way or the other. But for sure, Moses takes that and he's going to respond. And he's mm-hmm. like, he doesn't think that that's right. And so he's going to respond. And so the first thing that he says is, why, Yahweh, should your anger blaze against your people from whom you brought from the land of Egypt? Keep in mind, note that he turns God's words. He changes God's words and he says, no, these are not my people, God. Right. These are your people who you brought out. And so like a language that was attributed, like God said that you brought out Moses, like he doesn't take that. He's like, uh-uh, I didn't bring him out of Egypt. You brought him out of Egypt. That was you, not me. Mm-hmm. And so like it's a moment that Moses could start feeling somewhat prideful, and he's given an opportunity to say, yeah, I'll just make a great nation out of me. I don't really like these Israelites anyways.
Yeah.
They grumble against me in the desert whenever I'm just doing everything that you tell me to. And they just like, they're jerks to me. Yeah. So what? I agree.
Yeah.
Just be done with them.
I mean, they referred to him as this fellow Moses is just gone. Like they don't even
imagine. I mean,
have
like
any
that's
esteem for him.
That will be the natural human thing to say is that, or I would say, maybe I should better say, the unnatural thing that we've developed through our sin, we would want to say, yeah, make me a great nation. Mm-hmm. But he denied, like he pushes back against God and says, no, these are your people who you brought out of the land of Egypt. And then he petitions for them. The first thing that he does, so I'll read this. This is from W. Ross Blackburn. This is a kind of a long section, but I think it's really good. I think he wrote it really well. He says, Moses opens his intercession with a reminder of Israel's relationship to the Lord. The question why is rhetorical. Moses is not asking the reasons for the Lord's anger. He's already been told. Nor is he simply reminding him of what he has done for Israel. Rather, Moses' description of Israel in 32:11 as the people the Lord brought out with a great power and a mighty hand to serve, or serve to remind the Lord of his purposes in the plague, that is, to show Pharaoh my power, that my name may be declared throughout the earth. Unwilling for the Lord to forsake Israel, as implied when the Lord referred to your people and this people, Moses reminds the Lord that they are the Lord's people. In other words, Moses could be paraphrased to say, "You cannot assign this people to me, nor seek to replace it by me. This concerns not me, but you. This is your people. You are the one who brought it here." In effect, the effect of Moses' reference to Israel as the Lord's people is meant to suggest that the Lord has publicly bound himself to Israel. Having established the connection between the Lord and Israel, Moses follows with two direct appeals. First, he invokes the Lord's reputation, suggesting that the destruction of Israel will disparage the Lord's character in the eyes of the Egyptians. At stake here is exactly how the Lord wants to be known to Egypt. The implication of Moses' comment is that Egypt will continue to recognize the Lord as powerful, but also as evil. In other words, the Lord is not only concerned to display his power, but is also concerned to make known what kind of God he is. Moses' appeal is based upon the premise that the Lord seeks to make himself known as a God who is both powerful and good. So that's his first petition is based off of that. Like, what should the Egyptians say? Like, remember what you even did this for in the first place? Was to make yourself known, mm-hmm. not just to the Israelites, but also to Egypt, to the nations. Mm-hmm. This is for the nations. And if you do this, it's going to make you look like it's going to make you look evil. And you're not evil. You know, like that's how he's appealing to him. Is he saying you're not evil? And so don't do this because it's going to make you look evil. I think before we continue on to the next part of the appeal, there's two different appeals in here. Before you go on to the next one, I just kind of lost my train of thought. So he is saying, don't look evil before their eyes. I'm just totally lost my train of thought with that. okay. I'm going to go to the second.
Go to the second.
Yeah. Okay. So the second part of it, his second appeal, is dealing with Moses invokes the Lord's promise to the patriarchs. By emphasizing the promises to Moses, or the promises, Moses brings the Lord's integrity to the fore. Again, the issue is bound to the Lord's honor, this time as one who keeps his word. The appeal to the patriarchal promises may also have a wider scope. The reference to Abraham, Isaac, and Israel suggests the bond between the Lord and the people in a way that would not be so apparent if Moses had just mentioned Jacob. So just note that in your Bible, you'll see that he says Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Most of the time, it would say Jacob.
Instead of Israel.
Instead of Israel. But he uses the word Israel to tie it to the people.
Mm-hmm.
It is noteworthy that in neither case does Moses ground his appeal in Israel. He does not make light of her sin. Nor does he appeal to any special love the Lord may have for her. The grounds of Moses' appeal are concerned solely with the Lord's commitment to make himself known. As one who has a reputation to uphold, as one who has made promises he has sworn to keep, and as one who has embarked upon a plan to make himself known to the nations. In other words, Moses grounds his plea for Israel in the interest of the Lord himself. This must not be missed, for it is crucial for understanding what is at stake in the Lord's response to Israel. Rather than defending the people before the Lord, Moses defends the Lord before the Lord. On these grounds, the Lord reverses his decision to destroy Israel. So he appeals to two things, his reputation and his promises that he has made, and saying, no, you're a God that upholds, like that keeps his promises. That's how we started this podcast on Exodus, the God who keeps his promises.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I remember where I was going to go with that thought before, of that Moses is imploring, like he's diving into God's character, mm-hmm. and saying, no, this is who you are.
Yeah.
And what you just said is against who you are. And so along this way, the Lord has been trying to make himself known both to Israel and to the Egyptians. And Moses has like come to know him,
mm-hmm.
and come to know him in such a way that whenever God says this about Israel, he's able to say like, that's not in your character. Yeah. Like, that's not who you are. And I know it. I know that's not who you are. Yeah. And so how could you do such a thing? Because I know you're not evil. And if you were to do that, it would make you look evil. And they would think you're evil. And that's just not in your character.
Yeah.
And it's also not in your character to turn away from promises. And you made a promise.
Yeah.
And so you better keep it because that's who you are.
Yeah.
And not because I'm telling you you have to keep it, because that's who you are. That's like who you are as God, is that you keep your promises. And so it's like Moses is appealing, I don't think that he's saying, like, you know, actually, God, I have a better idea. I think he's saying, no. I don't think you really want to do this.
Yeah.
You know, I think God is drawing out of Moses what Moses has learned about him. Yeah. And so this is the way that we come to know who God is.
Yeah, and to me, the thing, I think this might have been the first thing that I said after we read this together was, wow, this section has really taught me how much we need an intercessor.
Mm-hmm.
And Moses, I mean, just like you mentioned that him and the Israelites, yeah, they might be kind of like his family now because he's been with them a while. But at the same time, they've grumbled against Moses mm-hmm. a ton. Like, they can't be like ultra tight necessarily. And so you have people who don't really deserve this grace and who have kind of attacked you in the past. And yet Moses is still going to God on their behalf so that he won't destroy them.
Yeah. And they don't even hardly know it.
Does that remind you of anyone else?
Yeah, exactly.
Of who is coming.
Right.
And so like that was just, I don't know. It was one of the first times where I could see, okay, like what Jesus did on a grander level.
Right.
What has already happened on smaller scales. This is a perfect example of, yeah, these people deserve your full wrath on them
mm-hmm.
because they have just broken your first command, you know, and in a way that is just
egregious.
It's just bad. And so like, yeah, you deserve to be mad. You have every right to be mad. But I want you to remember who you are
mm-hmm.
and stepping in for the people. And so that's just like, that has never really hit me in that way
yeah.
until we were reading this again.
Yeah, and Moses sets the pattern for the intercessor. I think maybe yeah. The only other thing I can think about is with Abraham, whenever with Sodom and Gomorrah, he actually intercedes for Sodom and Gomorrah, and he says, listen, is this really what you want to go do, you know? And he says, like, if you find 50 people, would you relent? You know, he's like, yeah, I would. And he's like, okay, 40 people? Yeah, yeah. It's not a bargaining, you know. The scene isn't one of bargaining. It's actually one of, like, Abraham's, like, searching for how merciful is God. And it's even down to, like, you know, what he goes down to 5 and then he doesn't go any further. Abraham doesn't. And so that's the first scene I remember of an intercessor. And then now we have Moses kind of setting, he's giving another example of what it looks like to be a good intercessor. And so as this righteous intercessor who goes before God for the people, Yahweh responds to it. And he relents concerning the disaster that he had threatened to do to his people. Actually, so just me saying that, I remember... This is straight out of, like, Jonah pulls that line right there and says that he relented concerning the, you know, or it's like a, who knows, you know, maybe the Lord will relent that he said, and then it says that he relented concerning the disaster that he had for Nineveh.
Mm-hmm.
So Jonah's like very much playing on this, and Jonah, we'll see later when we get to Exodus 34 where Jonah.
I know, it's so hard not to just go there.
Yeah, which is where it's all going, is Exodus chapter 34, verses 6 through 7. But this is displaying God's character. It's
mm-hmm.
that he relents concerning disaster, right? That he doesn't, yeah, they deserve it, but he's, after the intercessor comes in and says, this, you know, like, this isn't, this isn't what you're about, then he relents.
Yeah.
So like he's quick to forgive. And so that's where we pick up in, what is it? In
17.
Yeah. So he's starting to go back down the mountain,
right.
With the tablets.
Here comes Moses. All right.
Yeah.
When Joshua heard the noise of the people shouting, he said to Moses, "There is a sound of war in the camp." Moses replied, "It is not the sound of victory. It is not the sound of defeat. It is the sound of singing that I hear." When Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, his anger burned, and he threw the tablets out of his hands, breaking them to pieces at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf they had made and burned it in the fire. Then he ground it into powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it. He said to Aaron, "What did these people do to you that led them into such a great sin?" "Do not be angry, my lord," Aaron answered. "You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, 'Make us gods who will go before us.' As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him." So I told them, "Whoever has any gold, jewelry, take it off." Then they gave me the gold, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. Moses saw that the people were running wild, and that Aaron had let them get out of control, and so became a laughingstock to their enemies. So he stood at the entrance to the camp and said, "Whoever is for the Lord, come to me." And all the Levites rallied to him. Then he said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man strap a sword to his side. Go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor." The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died. Then Moses said, "You have been set apart to the Lord today, for you were against your own sons and brothers, and he has blessed you this day."
Okay. So Moses begins his trek down the mountain. He actually runs into Joshua. So we forgot about Joshua, that he's kind of in the middle.
Yeah.
And he can kind of, I guess maybe he watched Moses walk into the cloud, but he's also close enough to the people to be able to hear them.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Oh, you know, like, sounds like there's a war going on." And Moses like tells this little, he's like, says this little poem of like, "There's not a sound of victory. There's not a sound of defeat. I hear the sound of singing." And so the question is what are they singing? I feel like he's kind of like the Grinch, like that hears the singing of the mm-hmm. Who's like coming up, and yeah, his heart grows three sizes that day.
Yeah.
That's not how Moses feels about the situation. This is not the singing of the Who's in Whoville. He hears the sound of singing, but I guess for him, it's like, what are they singing about? He kind of knows God's already told him something bad happened. And so he hears the sound of singing. And as he comes to the camp, it says that Moses became angry. He burns hot, which is exactly what Yahweh said that he wanted to do. "Let me burn. Leave me alone so that I can burn against the people and be angry." And Moses actually tells him, no, don't do that. Like, why should your anger burn against the people? And so now Moses comes down the mountain. He actually sees what's happening and he burns hot. Like this is like the Lord's representative.
Yeah.
He's kind of the high priest at this moment. He's representing the Lord to the people. And so he is like Yahweh in a sense. Mm-hmm. He's like, he sees what's happening and his anger burns.
Yeah, it's one thing to hear about it, another thing to see it. And so now that he's finally seeing it, after probably, carrying these stone tablets that I imagine are pretty heavy down the mountain.
He's got sweet biceps.
Yeah, he's like, got great and forearms,
Like old man Moses with big biceps.
Yeah, so he's been carrying these down and he's like, maybe it's not as bad as, it's bad. It's bad. So, we're just at a place where he's pretty upset.
And he comes down and this is certainly symbolic of what happens. And we've heard so much about these tablets written with the finger of God, written on both. Like the last thing that we read before this was like a complete description of those tablets. We've had them less than a chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets down and he sees it and he throws the tablets on the ground and they shatter. And so it's symbolic of exactly what the Israelites did to the law that which they were given. They just threw it on the ground and shattered it on the ground by their actions, by what they did right out the gate, just not listening to God's law and obeying his commands. They totally destroy that relationship. In the in their actions. And so he does some weird things. He breaks them on the mountain, and then he takes the calf. You just see angry Moses coming down the mountain, like pushes the calf over. Somehow he like grinds it up. He burned it with fire and crushed it until it became fine. And he scattered it on the surface of the water, and then he made the Israelites drink it. I don't know that before I read this, I don't know that I ever knew that happened.
I don't think I did either. And I mean, that's intense.
Yeah.
That can't be good for the old digestive system.
It's not exactly, you know, like probiotics.
No.
And here's kind of what I think is going on here. Is that it's symbolic of what they've done with this idol, this thing that they've worshipped, that even if they wanted to attribute it to Yahweh, wasn't Yahweh. That basically by grinding it, putting in water, and having them drink it, and now like every one of them that worshipped it it's become part of who they are. It's the same thing that happens with the fruit, right? In Genesis chapter 3, they partake of it, they eat of it. It becomes part of who they are, part of their body. And that's what happens. Like sin is entangled within us, that it becomes part of who we are. And the things that we do, you know, are like it's mixed in with us. And so I think that's kind of what it symbolizes. There's also another thing from Numbers. This is probably, it's fairly well known because it's like a weird thing that everybody points out from Numbers. Of whenever a woman commits adultery or is caught in adultery or is suspected of adultery, that they take dirt or they take, yeah, I think they take dirt from the tabernacle, they put it, mix it into water, and they have her drink it. And, you know, I guess if she lives, then everything's good. You know, if she dies, then she committed adultery. It's a weird thing. You'd have to go to that, to Numbers, to maybe get it in better context. But the idea here is it's an adulterous woman. And now Israel, who I mentioned earlier, is the adulterous. It's like this adulterous woman in the relationship with Yahweh drinks of this mixed drink. It could be tied to that. I think it's probably more so the former that I mentioned, that it's like this idol, this thing that they worshipped, has become part of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's showing that infection kind of thing.
Yeah.
That is going to be part of them.
And I love then how Moses goes directly to Aaron, especially because Moses now has a better idea of what Aaron's role is supposed to be and mm-hmm. was supposed to look at. So he's, you know, holding him to a high standard, and he's like, you should have basically,
I left you in charge.
Yeah.
And you knew better.
Yeah. And so then you have, you know, the guy who was supposed to come in and be the speaker for Moses.
It's like, I had great news for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I had great news for you when I came down here.
Yeah. So, and now Aaron's response as the person who's supposed to be this great speaker is just, it's just laughable.
Yeah.
It's just like it's just a joke.
He's a big fraud.
Mm-hmm. Of just, you know, don't be angry. I mean, I think he does know he's messed up.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, I think there's no doubt. And his explanation to me, it's like sort of half truths. It's sure. Like some of the stuff is like word for word what happened earlier on in the narrative. Like, you know,
they said to me, make for us gods who will go before us. They said that.
Yeah. And they said, this fellow Moses who brought us out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him. And yeah, he did say, so I told them, you know, bring me your gold. But what did not happen is that he threw it into the fire and magically this golden calf
came out.
Just popped out.
No, he was actually involved. He seemed to use some sort of mold and some tool to form it. He was actively involved in this and played a part in it.
Yeah, and also how he's like, you know how prone these people are to evil, to start out his explanation with that, of kind of casting aside the blame on himself and just being like, you know, they're pushy, you've heard how they grumble against you, and they're just wah wah wah.
Yeah, so to me this replays the Genesis 3 narrative in that it's the same thing that the man does, where he says, this woman you gave me,
mm-hmm.
you know, she gave me the fruit, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I don't know what to tell you, God. Like it was the woman that you gave me. Yeah. and so it very much feels the same way. Aaron, who's supposed to be the one that is like instructing them, instead says, you know, these people, they're just, I mean, they grumbled against you, you know, and like, you know, like this is just how they are. And I really didn't have any options. And I was like, sure, I'll melt down some gold for you, you know, and then a calf came out. I don't know, you know, so like you can feel the excuse that he's making. That's very much replaying the Genesis 3 narrative. And so it's not good for Aaron. It does not look good for Aaron. And also I think, just to emphasize like how important it is as leaders, like whenever, if you're a leader, of the church of God, like of God's assembly, then there's a huge importance that you speak up when you're supposed to,
mm-hmm.
that you say the things that, that need to be said whenever the people are grumbling against you, when the people are trying to get you to do something that's not right. Like it's imperative that you step up, and you can't blame these people for it. You're their leader. You're the one that they look to. And just the same, Aaron is the one who is supposed to guide them and say, no, like calm down, everybody. Like this is, you know, we were given this, you know, this Torah. We've been led here. Remember what happened with the manna in the wilderness? Like you guys are being fed every day.
Yeah.
Like remember what God has done. Instead of doing that, he gives in to them. And so he, you know, he's the first one, like Moses directly addresses him because of that. And so there's a huge importance on the leaders.
Yeah. And just again, the last time that Aaron saw was like in the narrative, he was eating with God, mm-hmm. seeing God's feet on this sapphire.
Yeah.
Like,
pavement
surface
thing. Yeah.
And so yeah, I mean 40 days, that's a little over a month, but when you think about when they would have had to start this process of collecting the gold and making the calf and everything, it probably would have been, you know, maybe a month
yeah.
that he was gone. And it's just like there have been other things that have taken a lot longer, I feel like. Like their enslavement in Egypt was
yeah.
a lot longer.
Yeah.
and God still delivered them from that. And I just, like, it's just odd to me. I wish we knew a little bit more of what happened in those 40 days, if they ever, you know, like, cried out to God or anything, you know. But it just, you don't really get the sense that necessarily they did.
Mm-mm.
Of just like, where are you?
The feeling of the narrative is that they just immediately fail.
Yeah.
They just immediately, whenever they're faced with the first problem, they turn.
Yeah.
And they go back to what they remember.
Yeah.
And they go back to who they were.
Because it just kind of seems like, I don't know. I mean, Aaron had an idea of what was happening with Moses and God. I mean, he knew he was going to be going up there. I don't know that he knew how long it was going to be, but like, you know, he, you know, Moses had left him with instructions of just like, yeah, Aaron and Hur can help anybody with disputes and stuff. So you kind of get the feeling, okay, it's going to be more than a day. Like,
yeah,
it's going to be a little bit longer than a day or two,
yeah.
you know? So it's just, I don't know. It's just this weird thing of just, yeah, utter failure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I just think, again, it's interesting how it describes the people, that they were running wild because Aaron had allowed them to run wild.
Yeah,
and so they become this beast. What?
Just thought of a joke.
What?
Utter failure.
Oh, because of the calf.
Cow.
Yeah.
Jokes for days.
Oh, my goodness. So the running wild, like it gives it's this feeling of, I mean, bull in a china shop.
Yeah.
You know, that it's just like this, they've become like the thing that they worship.
Yeah.
And why did they become that way? Well, Aaron let them.
Yeah.
Aaron let them do that. And they were the laughing stock of their enemies. It's just that they're disorganized. They're not orderly, which shows that their leadership sucks. So that's what that means. And so Moses has a call. He's like, all right, if you're with Yahweh, come with me, come be with me. And he offers that up, that anybody wants to come, come and be with Yahweh. If you give your allegiance to Yahweh, come and be here. And it seems that the Levites at least were the most dedicated, the most ones that were like, yeah, let's do it. Like, we're with Yahweh. And as a consequence to that, anybody that didn't seem to be with Yahweh, they met their demise.
And they had an opportunity.
They had an opportunity to turn. And to say, no, I remember Holy Fire Mountain God, who I committed my life to, that I said was that I was in a covenant relationship with, and I'm choosing him. They chose not, and so they met the end that they would have met in Egypt.
Yep.
Which was death. And so that's hard. But I think that just shows, like, I mean, that yes, God is merciful. And God is he's quick to forgive. But at the same time, for those that continue in this way, and are dedicated to this path, that it's, you know, he's not going to leave the guilty to go unpunished.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just the tension we have to live in, that we have to be okay with. That's part of what, maybe it's worth saying that this is Moses doing this, but I think he's God's representative. I don't think that there's nothing negative in this that would make me think that what Moses did was wrong. It seems that he deals with the sin. Anybody that chooses to continue living in the sin, he deals with that. And God's covenant people. I think that's just what it is. And the Levites are the ones that are kind of, I guess, even though they failed, they're the ones that were most willing to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have this role as being dedicated to Yahweh. So I'll pick up in verse 30 and finish this out. And it says, "And the next day Moses said to the people, 'You have sinned a great sin, and now I will go up to Yahweh. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin.' And Moses returned to Yahweh, and he said, 'Alas, this people has sinned a great sin and made for themselves gods of gold. And now if you will forgive their sin,'" I mess that up every single time. "'And now if you will forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from your scroll that you have written.' And Yahweh said to Moses, 'Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him from my scroll. And now go, lead the people to where I spoke to you. Look, my angel will go before you, and on the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin.' And Yahweh afflicted the people because they had made a bull calf that Aaron had made."
So you kind of thought that Moses, you know, saying anybody who comes with me is coming back to God, basically, and is like repenting.
Mm-hmm.
But Moses is still like, we still have to address this sin, even though you guys have repented and, you know,
yeah,
you're coming. Yeah. You've turned. And yeah, even though we already killed all the ones who were like, no, we're not turning back to God.
Well, to be clear, he's already had Yahweh turn from his anger.
Yeah.
And not like, and hasn't destroyed them.
Right.
But in Moses's mind, there's still not atonement.
Yeah. Yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah, so then he's like, we have to deal with this somehow. And so his choice, and this is what I was getting to, I think I probably meant to mention it here, but I saw it in both places, of just, again, this need for an intercessor.
Mm-hmm.
This person, Moses, is going to go up back to Yahweh and say, like, please forgive them. And if not, like kill me instead of them, basically. Right. And where do we see that again?
Right.
And again, we see this in a case where, like we said, we've said this a couple times now in this podcast, of Moses, you know, these are people that have grumbled against Moses. These are people who at one point he felt like he was a foreigner from. But he does feel strongly enough about them to go to God on behalf of them. Now this being a second time.
Right.
And so
incredible. Yeah, and so the first time it was to, like, the first intercession was dealing with God's wrath and his anger so that he didn't destroy them. But again, it's not complete, because where this is going is God dwelling in and among his people, not just not being mad at his people, you know? And I think that's a lot of times what we think about with the intercessor. That's like, oh, just go talk to him and maybe he won't be mad at me anymore. You know, and it's not less than that, but it's for sure way more than that.
Mm-hmm.
In that, okay, so yes, he is caught, you know, he's interceded and said, hey, don't be mad at your people anymore. Remember, I know your character and I know that you're going to turn from this. Like, I know that this isn't how this is going to go down. And so God relents from destroying Israel. But Moses still sees a need for not just turning away his anger, but making atonement. So that atonement, I mean, just read the word itself. It's at-one-ment, that it is unifying them with God again. Not just not making them, you know, saying, hey, we're not mad at each other again, but saying we're going to reunite. I'm going to try to make it so that God reunites with you and doesn't forsake you and doesn't just leave you to your own, because I know how that goes too.
Yeah.
And so he says, perhaps I can go up and make atonement for your sins so that I can make you one with God again. And that you can continue or reestablish your covenant with him.
So this scene is reminding me a lot of Jesus on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's got the two criminals hanging next to him and he says, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. And I'm sure he's talking more than just the two criminals next to him.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
he's talking about the Romans that are right there, or the people that are mocking him, saying, hey, come down from here.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
If you claim to be the God of the universe, then why don't you come down?
Yeah,
you
know, so we have that. But then to your point about not just forgiveness, but also that fellowship, I think we forget about the part of him saying, like, today you will be with me in paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And just this idea of it's not just about forgiveness for the criminal. It's about being together with God.
Yeah.
And that's Moses is ultimately trying to get them back to a place where they can be with God, not just forgiveness of sins.
Yeah. And so he offers himself up. He says, now, please, you know, if you will, forgive their sin. And if not, kill me instead.
Mm-hmm.
Kill me on their behalf. Blot me out of your scroll that you have written. And essentially Yahweh says no to the offer. And so it begs the question of like, well, who can offer themselves up, you know, and be the one, you know, who, you know, that would die on behalf of his people. It's not Moses apparently. But it kind of leaves the door open for who can do such things. And then as a response, it says, and Yahweh said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him from my scroll. Now go lead the people from where I spoke to you. Look, my angel will go before you and on the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin. And Yahweh afflicted the people because they had made a bull calf that Aaron had made. So what ends up following here is that Yahweh says, no, that won't be necessary. I'll deal with that. I'll deal with their sin. It's not clear how. It's just not clear. It says that, you know, I'm going to punish them for what has happened, for their sin, but it's not clear how. It's not like nothing is clear about how that gets executed.
Yeah.
And it leaves the door open. It's like, okay, so I need an intercessor that is, that is able to stand in my stead and that also will take the punishment for the sin that we've committed. Okay. Like, how does that happen? And it's the door's just left wide open. There's no answer to the question here in Exodus 32. I think that very much leaves the door open for what Jesus does. And ultimately the answer to the question is who can stand in the gap and who can offer himself is no one but Yahweh himself. Mm-hmm. He's the only one that can stand in the gap. And so that is, I mean, that's the role that Jesus ultimately plays and what he does for his people. And it also just said, you know, like, it's just part of God's character, that he's not going to let the guilty go unpunished, that there is going to be a dealing with that. And that, you know, the story isn't over yet. This intercession isn't over yet. So don't think as we end Exodus chapter 32, that's hardly the beginning of what's going to happen. But yeah, I think, ultimately what we see here, is a really beautiful display of Moses standing in for the people and being an intercessor for people that don't deserve it, for the people that have just so readily and easily turned away. Mm-hmm. He stands in the gap and says, you know, if you can't forgive them, then take me instead. And that's the person that we need as we go forward in the story.